Welcome everyone to the American Carpet Podcast, where we discuss all things carp related in the USA. Featuring anglers' interviews, stories, and monthly competitions with traditional US and Euro anglers, fly anglers, and anyone who has a passion for this incredible fish, the carp, Cyprinus carpio. Much maligned and misunderstood, and undoubtedly one of the finest sport fish to be targeted here in the USA. This is where we, the guilty ones, can meet. My name is Sean Manning of the American Carp Society, and I'm grateful to be your host. Welcome, everybody. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you haven't done so already and share with your friends. Today, our special guest, who is well known throughout the US carp angling community, is a really good friend of ours, and he probably has caught more large carp than any other angler I know of in the United States. Our friend and legend of the East Coast, Mr. Scott Osmond. Scott, it's been too long, my brother. How are you?
Not too bad. Haven't talked to you in a very long time.
It has been a long time. In fact, I think the last time we saw you, last time we spoke, was probably at the Texas Carp Challenge, wasn't it? 2006?
It was. 14 years ago.
Wow. That was quite a memorable event. It was great to have everybody down there. And it was quite a memorable event for you, wasn't it, as well?
Yeah, it was. Everything turned out great.
It did. And we're going to get into that a little bit later on in the show, because there was a rather unique format for that tournament. But before we do that, for any of those that don't know of Scott, he's been fishing for a long time here in the United States. He's based on the East Coast. Scott, can you give us a little bit about your background? How long have you actually been fishing for carp for here in the United States?
Well, back in 1982, I was 7 years old. And we ran into some friends that were fishing for and caught this massive fish. It was probably a 5 or 6 pound carp. And my father and I, you know, quizzed them on what they will use, and it was just the standard dreaded oatmeal ball, dough ball.
Right.
So that's where we ended up figuring out how they used it, and we went on from there. And my very first carp at that time was 19 and a half pounds, which was pretty impressive considering I weighed about 45 pounds at the time. And that's, I've been hooked ever since. So about 38 years.
Yeah, and you've been doing it for a long time. And do you target any other fish, or do you specifically target carp?
Many years ago, I targeted a variety of fish.
Yeah.
I just never found the same passion, the same enjoyment. If there's opportunities to catch large fish of other species, I will. But generally speaking, if it wasn't for carp, I would fish for smallmouth bass all the time. But other than that, it's, my passion has just always been with carp. It's the other fish, the other species of fish are amazing, fun. They just don't do
they don't match up, do they?
They don't. And I can't put my finger on it except for the fact that no matter what you want to do in the world of fishing, carp fishing and angling gives you it, lets you do it, pursue it any way you want to do it. So
Yeah. And I mean you fished quite a bit. How often do you get out in a week?
Not as often as it seems, and usually I have an odd work schedule, so I'm basically, even on my on off days, I'm waking up at about 2 or 3 in the morning.
Okay.
So I'm generally done fishing 1 to 2 times a week up until about 11 a.m. And possibly once or twice a week if the conditions are perfect locally, where I can get out for an hour or two after work. But generally speaking, it's probably maybe 8 to 10 hours a week.
Okay. And that's, I mean, for some of us, that's that we're salivating at that. That would be wonderful to be able to do that.
I understood that.
Yeah. So you're in Massachusetts, right?
Yep. Yes, sir.
Yep. How far from your work and from your house are your local waters? Do you have to travel that far to them, or are they pretty close?
No. I'm blessed with the fact that within an hour and a half, let's say,
yeah,
generally within an hour, I can hit at least 100 different waters, 100 different kinds of waters.
Oh, wow.
From big rivers to small rivers, creeks, ponds, big lakes, shallow lakes, deep lakes. I mean, I have pretty much a smorgasbord of different types of waters, which really comes in handy when you don't have a lot of time. There's always something there. Yeah, there's always an opportunity somewhere. You can find it pretty easily.
Yeah. Yeah. And who would you say, when you first, you know, got into it, who would be your, because we all have influences and people that, that guide us, you know, when we're younger. Who was it that, that kind of, that was the biggest influence on you, do you think?
Early CAG days, it was probably Nigel Griffin.
Right.
I did look up to him and really, really asked him a bunch of questions, as if you do get to talk to him, and he'll remind you of the hundreds of phone calls that I would pepper him with in Connecticut back in the mid-90s. Other than that, there's a lot of anglers that I respect and take something away from, but I've always kind of not really followed anyone.
Yeah. No, you've always been out there doing your own thing. And I wanted to, one of the things I wanted to ask you about, because I remember us having a conversation a number of years ago in regards to one topic and one word, bread. So let's just look at that, because I know you've used it an awful lot. And in the day and age that we are now with technology and everything, and there's so many different, you know, bait types available and that type of thing, I know you have caught a large amount of fish on simple white bread. So can you tell the listeners how you act? Just tell them how you use it.
Depends on the water, of course, and the conditions you have in front of you. Yeah. It's very easy. The reason I use it basically is I move around a lot. I'm very, very mobile. I keep moving till I find fish somewhere, at every time. There's always fish somewhere that are biting. So I'm constantly on the move, and bread makes it very easy to just bring out, bait out, and put it out there. And with its high starch content, generally most waters, they're pretty easygoing when it comes to taking bait, even new waters.
Yeah.
But usually, because I use bread probably 80 to 90% of the time, I have to be opportunistic. Mm-hmm. A lot of the waters and places that I'm fishing, whether they're big rivers, even into lakes, I have to get to places where they're obviously within 15, 20 yards of shore.
Right.
And rivers really, really help for that, because current breaks are generally close to the shore and allow you to use it more effectively.
Are you freelining it?
I try to. Yeah. So probably 90% of the time I'm freelining, mostly on the bottom. It's rare, but really nice when they're able to come to the surface.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, that doesn't happen a lot. So it's fishing on the bottom like you normally would with any other bait, except it's just different setup.
Do you use any weight at all, or do you just use the weight of the bread?
I try not to. In certain conditions, if I'm fishing a little bit higher up and there's a little bit of wind, I'll use smaller split shots just enough to peg it down to kind of work against the wind, if there's any wind, let's say. But usually I try to just freeline and let them pick it up. The simplest and most sensitive rig you could use, even more simple than a float, would be just freeline and watching.
Of course, yeah. And you just watch the line twitching.
Yep. I try to, but sometimes the line rips off an open spool at 100 miles an hour.
It's a wonderful, and I brought it up, Scott, specifically because I knew that was how you approached him. And I've done a lot of, in the past, especially over in England, just pinch bread flake. It's a direct contact with the fish, isn't it? Because there's nothing else in between you and the fish. And the way that you approach it, from what you're telling me, it's actually very similar to a fly angler. You're pretty much stalking all the time. You're not sitting down there with the BB for 48 hours in one spot at all, are you?
Correct. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're always on the move. And I would imagine, I'm just taking a guess here, but because of that, and that has been your primary approach, you're pretty much your carp fishing life, isn't it?
It is. It's allowed me to be able to be opportunistic, learn the waters. The more you move and the more opportunistic you have to be, the quicker you learn watercraft and the quicker you can find the fish, which, yeah, when you don't have a lot of time fishing, that's the number one goal. You have to find fish. You don't have much time. It's daybreak at 6. You're done carp fishing by 11.
By 11, yeah.
Yeah, so you're pretty much, you have to be, that's it. That's all you have for the week.
I was going to say, Scott, I was going to say that your watercraft skills would grow incredibly quickly by approaching your fishing in that manner, because you always have to be looking, you always have to be observing movement of the fish. And I say that because I just finished a podcast with a fly angler, and they're approaching it in exactly the same way. They're always on the move, they're looking for the carp feeding, and that's pretty much your approach. And I would hazard a guess that's the reason why you're so prolific in what you do, because you catch a great deal of carp, and they're all large as well. You do catch big fish, and I know you and I have joked about it in the past, and you know, you'll post the fish of another 30 plus, and I'll say was another one of your minnows, Scotty. But you do catch, you've got an abundance of really large carp, brother. You have caught consistently again and again and again for many years. So any anglers that are listening to this today, I would really encourage you to go to the basics, really simple: bread, a hook, and watercraft, and that's pretty much it, bud, yes. Isn't it?
Yeah, and now any advice on new anglers would be simply that, would be learning the fish before you're learning the exotic baits, the rigs and whatnot, and just be prepared that along the way you're going to not guess right. You're going to get to places where you're just not able to find the fish, you know, hammer the round pig through the square hole, that sort of thing. And what you end up doing is learning watercraft. You guess why the fish weren't there. Yeah. And then you try a new approach to the same water, same conditions, see if it works. And when it does work, you create a memory bank in your head. And the next time that you have similar conditions and similar type of water or similar place, you pull on that and you kind of what worked before in these conditions.
Yeah.
And it's so easy to draw, but if you're really involved in the, you know, bait of the week, bait of the month, the rig of the month, the gear, it's very hard to process that. It's very hard to learn watercraft when you don't have to.
Well, and you're caught up if you're doing all of that, and that's very common for new anglers getting involved in it. But don't you think also, Scott, that a part of the reason for that now is because of their access to technologies? Because check it out, when you were fishing in the 80s and when I was fishing in the 80s, there was no internet.
Right, absolutely. No, and it's,
you know,
that's made a huge impact, and it's very easy to want the new gadgets, the new baits, because they do work if applied correctly.
Yeah.
And that's the first thing you see when you scan a lot of the pages around the different anglers that are very successful. A lot of them really, really know how to use this equipment, the new rods, reels, gear, bait, especially know how to apply the certain bait.
Yeah.
But along the way, the most consistently successful anglers are the ones that will apply that with watercraft they've already been able to learn from.
And that comes from obviously experience and getting out there and doing it. But I do kind of empathize with youngsters getting involved in it now, because they have too much information. Don't they have too much information, and a lot can be lost. And the most important thing for any angler is watercraft, because without it, it doesn't matter. If you've got, you know, an incredible bait, but it's not in front of a fish, there's nothing there to eat it.
It's not working.
Yeah.
and that's what I've always, the newer anglers that I do run into and share with locally.
Yeah.
I try to let them know what to look for, the times when the fish are generally the most active. I generally, and most people will know that's been carp fishing a while, why this is the case. I don't, you know, give out specific locations anymore.
No.
Venues, things like that. There's a reason for that. Everybody knows why the reason is. But what to look for, how to go about, you know, traveling around, going to different waters, different conditions, different places, and learning why the carp are acting different in a small pond on a 90 degree day rather than a big river with the water up in late April. They're going to act completely different.
That's a really good point. It's a really good point. It's really understanding the quarry, isn't it, that you're going after, and understanding, and it's almost, you've got to think like the fish, and you have to really understand them. And the, I think the more that you do, and the more you understand the biological aspects and the environment in which they live, the more successful that you're going to be as an angler. So let's discuss that 2006 Texas Carp Challenge that you came out to, Scott, because that was a really unique event, wasn't it, in terms of its format?
It was. I know that it was in conjunction with the ATC and my father, the Austin Team Challenge. That was one of our favorite events back then anyways.
Oh, yes, so historic, yeah.
It was a great event to bring teams together, and my father and I really enjoyed that aspect, to come down. The people that we met down there were great. The fish were obviously amazing back in the early days of Town Lake. I'll always call it Town Lake.
Yeah, me too. But I can't get around this Ladybird Lake thing, can you?
I don't understand
that. What the heck's that all about, you know?
Absolutely. But to piggyback that on time-wise off of the ATC was perfect. It created a buzz. Especially with the $250,000 prize that was offered in it, it really opened eyes to the potential of carp angling here. When I first saw the format of it, my heart raced. I know
that's
perfect
for you. That's perfect.
Oh, it is, absolutely.
Yeah.
You do have to get lucky, and I'm sure we'll talk about how lucky I ended up getting during it. But being able to work with Andy and Dennis from Resistance Tackle as a team, and you already had results from the 2 days of the ATC and the pre-fishing to give you an idea of what was going on at the lake at the time.
That's right.
So there was a lot of information to go on, where you really had to go through all the information, process it, get lucky in the draw, and then apply what you knew and go from there. The format was excellent. Everything, the whole application and format of that tournament was just special.
And let's discuss that a little bit, because it was an somewhat of an open format, wasn't it? After the first 12 hours or something? Because you could move anywhere.
Correct. And it allowed for, this is what I'm banking on. 12 hours later, while the conditions have changed, the fish are, strong. And that happens way more than it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So it allowed you to reassess on new current information, because it's pre-spawn fish, just pre-spawn fish at the time. So you were constantly gathering information by watching the water, seeing what the fish were doing, the temperature of the water, the weather, everything else. And then obviously you're getting catch reports around. So it gave you an idea to reassess all that information, look back on the map and say, this was the wrong approach. Check in with the headquarters and say, okay, are these spots open? This would be my next guess based on the information I know. Yeah. I can now move over to here. Is anyone there? No. Good. Now I can pack up, and you had still 4.5 days at that point to rock and roll. So, it really gave you the opportunity to get it right. It wasn't you pick a certain peg, you're stuck with that for 5 days. If the fish are a half a mile away from you, good luck. Thanks for the entry fee. This was something special, and I enjoyed every minute of it.
And because of your approach and the way that you approach your angling, and in fact, actually, you and Al Sincere, who eventually won that tournament, you both approached it in a similar way. Because obviously, because Wayne and I and David, Wayne and I were traveling around together, and we would be able to come and see and visit with all of the anglers, And after the first day, it would really mess some of the anglers up, because they'd put some bait in and they didn't know whether they were going to move and they didn't know where the fish were and that type of thing. But you and Al, both of you, Al Sincere, we're talking about now, you guys moved and, on the fish. And it's taken all of that research and knowledge and understanding and skill sets of how to read the waters to to find out where you should actually be. And that, I think that was one of the benefits of not being encumbered, like you said, with this is your peg, work, you know, you just got to work
the best
the peg.
Yeah.
And it really paid off for you, didn't it? So I know when we saw you, you were, where were you? You were up towards
First Street.
That's right.
Yep. Yeah. Right through the middle. And there was a reason for that.
Why did you make that? So just go into that. Why did you choose that area?
Okay. During the ATC, day one, my father and I actually had that same peg and we absolutely hauled. The water conditions at the time were perfect pre-spawn. It was between 60 and 62 during the day.
Yeah.
And we caught 20 fish that day between my father and I just in the ATC in the 12 hours, including a 40 plus pounder.
Right.
The second day it struggled a little bit, but when Dennis, Andy and I went around the lake, we did, you know, after day two, we took temperatures of the different parts of the lake. We had already ruled out Lake Travis, and any of the other surrounding waters like Lake Austin, mm-hmm. only because our goal was the big commons, and the biggest commons at the time and probably still are typically are found in Town Lake.
Yep.
So we narrowed it down for the, you know, 5 miles length of it. Up closer to Redbud, we found out that the water temperature was in the lower 70s. Some of the fish had already started their spawning dance.
Spawning, yeah.
And during the 2 days of the ATC, that ended up playing out. There were very few fish caught up there. Closer to the dam, it was the same situation. I believe over by the island in the gazebo, I got 68 and 74 degrees for water temperature when we had gone around it. I know that a lot of people were banking on that area, but it was like just, we're talking a 5 day tournament where that spawn can trigger at any time. However, the middle of the lake, from about the Chicken Swim all the way past Barton Springs, the temperature everywhere was between 59 and 62 degrees. And that's the way it was during the first day of the ATC. So when mm-hmm. we were talking, we obviously worked as a team, the three of us. We didn't want to give that information at all. At this point, we were looking to get as lucky as we can and, you know, pick as early as possible in the draw. And we were going to all three, we had already looked on the maps where we were going to hit that section of the lake. That's where we banked on because of the current condition. Now, had it been a week later, things would have been completely different.
All of your decisions were made up to this point. The majority of them were made based upon temperatures.
Yes. Because we were so close to the spawn at that time, it was the very beginning of April in 06. It was very, very close to the spawn at that time. I believe the year before the spawn out there was at the end of March. Mm-hmm. But they hadn't spawned, which was great setup for the tournament because you've got heavier female fish.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that really worked out. So we were constantly watching, typically 65 to 70 steady with the moon phase will trigger spawns or can trigger spawns. We were looking for the cooler water temperatures, and we found them from, and I don't know if it has anything to do with Barton Spring, which I believe it might have, but through that middle part of the lake from First Street, you know, a quarter of a mile each direction of First Street, the water stayed well under the threshold where it usually triggers the spawn. So if there were fish there, we reasoned, and there were day one of the ATC, so we knew that there were at least some fish there, that they were still going to be pre-spawn, still feeding, rather than starting the pre-spawn ritual dances, floating around the shorelines, connecting with each other, and then just triggering. And that's, you know, past experiences. You talk about the watercraft, the information at that time that I knew, we had all put together what we knew, the three of us, and that's the game plan we came up with.
Yeah, and it paid off. It really paid off. It did for you, and it did for Al too. When we kind of looked and finalized everything, I think looking back at it, everybody had a wonderful time. I know we did, and all you anglers had a great time there. And I can't forget looking at, you know, talking to Al once it you know, when we'd weighed the fish and everything, and I said to him, I said, look, you be smart with that money, man. That's $100,000 or whatever it was, $250,000. And then I was a couple of years later on, there was an interview with him. And I think the interviewer was asking him, you know, about the winnings, and just classic Al. His one line was, I blew it all on money and women.
Money and women.
Or women and wine or something.
He, yeah, as one of the most creative anglers I've ever met, certainly one of the best at watercraft and best anglers I've come across in my time. The fact that he had moved off so quickly from the wrong section of the lake.
Yeah, he was down the gazebo. Yeah.
Right. And that's, he knew that. He picked that up on that, where it took other anglers days or even the full 5 days to realize, to figure it out. Whereas as soon as he was able to move, he kept finding the fish. He moved, found where the fish were in the middle of the lake, not far, I believe, from the chicken swim, where the water tended to be a little bit lower. And then you put an angle like that in front of fish, the biggest fish are generally going to come to the shoreline. And he hit the 43 plus, and it didn't really shock me. Yeah. And Dennis and Andy also had some very large fish, and they were very close.
They were
doing what I do. So it was, it was the right approach at that time, at that tournament. And Al certainly he was one of the very few anglers that did it right. Okay, I guessed wrong here. This is why, analyze everything. Bang, this is where I'm going to go. He ended up really, really looking around for using his watercraft, and he deserved that quarter mil.
Yeah, no, he did. He's obviously, he was a wonderful angler. We've always had a whole bunch of fun with him whenever, because he would travel with Wayne and Dave and I when we went to the St. Lawrence for the World Cup Championship and that type of thing. And some of the stories with him, he's just a hoot. He's an absolute riot, you know.
He loves life.
He does. He loves life, bless him. And I think he fishes an awful lot for big catfish and alligator gar and stuff.
Yes.
Now. Yeah, he does a lot of that. I wanted to ask you, Scott, because I know you're based on the East Coast and you've done some traveling before. Are there any waters in the United States that you haven't fished that you would like to?
It's back in 2009, before I got married and my life changed a little bit, mostly definitely for the better. But I was doing a lot of traveling, a lot of road trips. My big road trip that I wanted to do was to drive across the Route 80 and 90 corridor all the way out to Washington, fishing as I go, and pioneering some of the waters out there. One in particular nobody had fished yet was Moses Lake, because there had been a few really massive fish caught. It was out of a state that I've never fished before, and beautiful scenery. That, even though the fishing isn't what we had expected back then, the people, the anglers are still, that would still be one of the waters that I would like to do, because it's 11 years later and I haven't been able to go out there.
Gotcha.
There's every state has one or two waters where when I look at the map and do research, I have it in my head. That's going to be where I target if I ever get out to that state. Yeah. So every state has at least one or two waters that I just dream of fishing. So Moses Lake was one that I missed out on. That's one that I would like to sit and set up and really, really fish hard to see what I could do there. But generally every state has them. Your Blackfoot, your historical waters like Blackfoot, and now the Dale Hollows, the different waters that are just with stunning species, just to do it once.
I hear you. Yeah, I hear. And I think because now of the advent of social media, there's obviously a lot more fish that we're seeing that are coming out. There could have been a lot of fish being caught back then, but you know, the information exchange wasn't obviously what it is now. But there is a lot of beautiful fish, especially on the East Coast, a lot of mirrors over in your way, as opposed to, you know, central, I suppose, unless you get up more north, you know, Utah, Wyoming, places like that. But there's some a lot of beautiful fish that are coming out, and people are doing a really good job with the with the sharing of the information, I suppose, aren't they?
It really puts an exclamation point on just how beautiful the fish are. 15, 20 years ago, the size of the fish and the amount of the fish coming out across the country, no one would have believed it. If you, you know, 20 years ago, if you had said the fish that are coming out now, first of all, if you said that there's going to be something like a Facebook or other social media, people would look at you like you're crazy. But yeah, if you'd said that there were going to be such an amount of big fish coming out, which then inspires other anglers to get out there and do it, people would have probably said, you're kind of crazy.
Yeah.
You know, 40 pounder is very rare. It's always going to be rare. You know, that's just because the information wasn't there. It wasn't put in a social media, you know, setting where yeah, everybody could see it at all times and then absolutely drool when they see these classic pictures that American Carp Society is famous for. The people displaying the fish as actual prizes. That inspires a lot of people to do more than they would have 20 years ago. So now the anglers are getting better.
Yeah, I think it does, Scott. And I think you point something out. And we're really pleased with, especially, you know, over the last 3 to 4 years too, there's been a lot of, I think, and again, it's obviously in conjunction with technology, because there's a lot of influences, not just from here, but there's obviously influences from overseas, and the world has become smaller. You know, the world has become much smaller. And so we all have friends now, you know, via social media over in Europe on the other side of the planet. And we all have the same thing in common. And that was one of the things that we always used to love about seeing everybody and getting together, is because no matter what part of the United States that we were from, or what part of the world that we are from, you know, come to that fact, we all had this incredible passion and love for this species, you know, the carp, and the love for sharing that with others. Especially, it's one of those things, if you're an angler, if you're a fisherman, and you know, which means you've caught carp, you understand the fish, and you understand, you know, from an adversary foe perspective, for you as the hunter angler, so to speak, there's just nothing else that, you know, in freshwater pretty much like them. You want to share that with other anglers. So I think the social media aspect has gone past it, definitely at a certain point, and it's probably to do with, you know, generational, but at a certain point, you know, we were looking at it as, is it good, is it bad, is it a good thing, is it a bad thing. It's gone way past any potential bad thing now, to where it's really positive. And I think it's done a lot. I think it's done a lot to,
for the, you know, image to of the raise, fish.
Yeah, the profile, isn't it?
There's still things that you have to watch out for, obviously, on social media, that there's always bad that comes across with that much information sharing. Especially a species of fish that takes 15, 20, 25 years just to reach their top end size.
Yeah.
But overall, for the actual image, very few places where you go now where, you know, they're trash fish. And it's generally replaced by, boy, I wouldn't mind trying to catch that. Wow, there's, you know, they're actually quite pretty. All the
it's
things
changed,
you would never have heard.
It?
Yeah, you would never have heard that 20 years ago.
No,
never.
You wouldn't. And it has changed. And I think we're both lucky enough to have been able to be able to say that we've seen that, a significant change. And I know, you know, for the next generation, it will obviously change even more. So it's good to know that the, you know, all the work that we all as anglers put in and for the love of the fish is being shared with others. With all of the captures that you've had, Scott, over your lifetime, outside of the 2006 Texas Carp Challenge, because obviously that was a very special fish for you, for us, if that makes sense, because we obviously hosted the tournament. Do you have any captures that are specifically stand out for you, that are meaningful outside of that one? Because, I mean, if you said no that you didn't, I'd totally understand, because you caught so many bloody fishes that are large and are special. But do you have any that really stand out for you?
There, generally now it's hard to fall in love with just one fish, only because in order to go after the next whatever my goal is, you have to almost say, take a deep breath, look at the picture, post it, take a deep breath, enjoy it for the moment, and then it's off to the next one. However, in 2005, after quite a few years of nobody catching any carp and not being able to catch anything on Tom Hannock Reservoir, mm-hmm. I had actually with a friend of mine the year before, hatched a plan to try. And that was stocking the fish with naturals. We tried stocking them in the shallows with, we had your standard sweet corn, bread, everything else we could find, because we were coming back from the Hudson River. So we actually had boilies, everything that, I think we had tiger nuts too, but we weren't applying them correctly. Right. But we were watching these fish, and some really big fish, totally ignoring our baits for everything else. Your red worm beds that they were just destroying. They were eating little snails off. We were watching them just eat the snails right off of these grassy reeds. Mm-hmm. And we couldn't get them to bite at all. So the following year, I actually, went down there. It was a little bit before the World Carp Cup. It was about a week before, and they were just about ready to spawn. So they were in the shallows, and one of the back bays, I bought some very, very small worms. That's the closest that I could get to natural. Right. And that 41-plus-pound two-tone mirror, which was in its glory then, very pre-spawn, very, at its peak in size, ended up taking, I had to make a perfect cast. But that landing that fish, A, it was by far my biggest mirror carp at the time. B, it was such a beautiful two-tone mirror out of a place where we had, as carp anglers, had failed so many times. We had seen carp rolling over our baits for hours. And just to be able to land such a fish, that one still stands out in my mind as one of my all-time favorites. And
that's awesome.
That started the Tom Hanek as, one of the... one of the big fish waters, the most well-known waters. And since then, there's been a lot of great fish for other people, a lot of memories for it. So I'm very, very proud of that fish. That's one
enjoyed. That's great. That's great, Scott. You mentioned something earlier on that I wanted to touch on, because Eric Mabry and I were talking about it a few weeks ago, because you said, you mentioned bait application. And I think it's really important for anglers to understand that any bait, if it's applied in the correct manner, can be phenomenal. And a phenomenal bait that is not applied correctly or introduced correctly won't really do anything for you. So let's talk about, because I know before in the past, and you and I have had discussions with, float fishing, because I usually love float fishing, you're using bread and mashing it up and applying it to get them to actually turn on to the bait. Let's just talk about bait application from your perspective. How important is it?
Well, nowadays, especially, you've got a lot of boiling companies that are making actually fairly high quality baits. And you've got the people that their entire approach is to bait. They have the resources and the go get them to actually get out there and, really, really put in and apply a high quality bait over time. Whereas it may not be as instant. So for boilies, the 2006, the TCC was actually, we had Bill Dowler's 150 pounds of Bill Dowler, his bait. He made some of the best boilies I've ever seen quality wise. Mm-hmm. Over the course of 2 to 3 days, I was introducing them with chops and then mixing them in with other baits and then starting to apply them as the main course. Mm-hmm. And on the third day, when we had the 10 inches of rain in the TCC, I couldn't buy a bite on popped up corn. Right. They were all eating. And when you did land the fish, they were pooping out the pineapple boilies, Bill Dowlers, because I had applied it in a way where anything that came over there would eventually turn on to a better quality bait. And it does work. Yeah. If you're done now, had I just gone day one, full guns blazing, sending out, double boilies on the bottom, double 24 mils on the bottom, I don't know if I would have been able to have hit the amount of fish that I would have over the course of 5 days. Yeah. Fourth and fifth day were just excellent. And they had accepted a high quality bait over that time as a main course. And what a lot of people don't understand is even the most high quality, your boilies typically aren't instant as your tiger nuts with the high sugar content or bread. Right. Yep. So it's there over time, if applied correctly, the fish will understand that it's a higher quality bait. They will tend to turn over. If you're introducing them with the other baits, getting them in the area, and steadily eating it and using it. But if you're just, if you come right in full guns blazing and fish next to somebody with a popped up tiger nut, on a, especially on a place where they really key in on naturals, you're not going to do very well at the beach. You have a great bait. It's not applied properly. The fish don't understand what it is, what they have. You understand that the fish don't.
Yeah.
So you have to match it and then introduce. And then over time, they will understand that this is a higher quality bait. So
yeah. You're right. It's a turnaround time for them to understand really, you know, really what it is. And that was what I was getting to with the question, because it has to be introduced correctly. And it doesn't matter. I think probably outside of corn, and you mentioned tiger nuts, I mean, the one bait where you can, I mean, in an hour, you can go to a lake, you go to a pond, you can find some fish, bread.
Yeah,
we'll do it for you.
It's not a lot of waters out there, and there are a couple, though, where I've watched fish ignore bread, not understanding what it is. You put sweet corn in front of them, and they're right on it. One of the waters was funny. A few nights ago, I had three very big fish in a very short amount of time, and that water, I've fished it before with bread, and it's very, very tough. For some reason, they don't understand what bread is, but they know what sweet corn is. They're on the sweet corn immediately.
Yeah.
And there's another angler locally way out, you know, in central New York that does fish the same water. And he's tried, you know, your tiger nuts, your boilies, he's tried introducing over time, and sweet corn does the trick there. But for the most part, you come in anywhere with bread, they can understand the starch, the high sugar content, and they'll take it.
Yeah. And I think you're right. I think it's being able to be smart enough to experiment as well. Experiment, move, think outside of the box, introduce different things. I remember when Wayne and David went up to Blackfoot for the first time. I was over in Europe at the time.
Yep.
They couldn't catch a bite. The carp up there were on naturals. The only thing that they could catch carp on was strawberry boilies. They wouldn't eat pineapple boilies. They wouldn't eat anything else. Strawberry boilies. That's the only thing that they would eat.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I don't know whether it was because they were all on bloodworm beds. It was something to do potentially with the color or what it was.
Yeah.
But they tried absolutely everything up there. So bait application, understanding it in any environment, obviously is really important, you know, for any angler. I think, Scott, you know, with the years that I've known you, you're probably one of the most consistent anglers out there, because you are so dedicated to it. And I think probably the final question, you know, of this episode for you is this: because you have a very go and get it attitude with the fish, which you've mentioned a couple of times, I think that's really important. I think that has a lot to do with your success. But I also want to ask you, on the flip side, you've caught so many fish, brother, over your lifetime. What is it that makes you still want to get up every single day and get to that water?
There's always a goal. There's always something different, and my heart still pounds. When the other day, when I had a really large fish come up to the surface and inspect the bread for a full 10 seconds and finally slip forward and inhale it. It's still as heart pounding now as it was 20, 30 years ago. And
there you go.
That's why I'm still 3 a.m., 4 a.m. looking at the conditions of the local weather, the local waters, you know, here, there, no, no, here, here. Okay. Well, this I think can go with the water to this high, you know, and I plan for the day. I'm still anticipating that I'm going to have some experience like that. Now, it doesn't happen a lot, because there's a lot of places where I just completely get it wrong. I stalk fish and look like a complete buffoon quite a bit, that it's, if people were with me, they would laugh. The one thing about carp is, you know, I can do everything right or think I'm doing everything right, and completely blow a chance at a very large fish for something I did. And it, they can, I mean, you're,
they will humble you.
They will humble you. Yeah. If you're just off a little bit, you let the wind take the bait just so, and you didn't mend the line just so, something looks different. It's gone. That's it. That's the only, you've just wasted
that chance.
It's been 45 minutes. You've been stalking that fish. You just blew it. The fish spooked off, and all you see is a cloud of mud there where the fish was. And that's it. Now you have to take a deep breath, start over. And sometimes that's very difficult to do. And that happens way more than successes.
And I think, and I think it's that commitment and the dedication and that love of the fish that has you go through that again and again and again and again and again. Mm-hmm. And that's what raises the average of the game, I think, every single day. Every single day. Each month, Scott, on the American Carper podcast, we run a competition for the listeners. Sure. So before we get to the September competition, we have to give a big shout out to the winner from last month. So our winner for the August competition was Mr. Brad Allen from Washington. So well done, Brad.
Hey, congratulations, Brad.
And American Carp Society baseball cap is on its way to you. And so for the month of September, we're going to be giving away another American Carp Society baseball cap and, to the lucky winner, a bottle of the Barnaby's Revenge bait spray. And so the question for September is this. In what year was the very first custom-made ACS rod introduced? In what year was the very first custom-made ACS USA carp rod, the Eurostyle, introduced? So send in your answers, everybody, to info@americancarpsociety.com with September competition answer in the subject line, along with your name and address, and the winner will be pulled out of the hat at the end of the month and announced the following month.
I remember those rods. They were beautiful.
They were, weren't they? That's about all we have time for today, everyone. I'd like to thank our guest, Scott Osmond, for his insight and his friendship and his support for not only the fish, but the American Carp Society over the years. Thank you so much, Scott. If any of you have questions for him, he can be reached through the American Carp Society and our members group Facebook group for any related questions. Also, Scott, what, is there a good way for anglers, if they want to get in contact with you, to reach out to you?
Probably the best way would be to find me on Facebook. I do have a lot of the mutual friends with a lot of the people, other carp anglers. I try the best I can to get, because I have a lot of people that do contact me through the private messaging, and I try to help out the best I can when I'm able to. So that would probably be, because I don't check emails very much. I'm not good on the telephone, as you can see. So on Facebook, if you find my name, not a very handsome guy, but the fish looks great. And
you look beautiful to me, buddy.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll be back here same time, same place, 2 weeks from now. So don't forget to join us. You can reach out to us here at the American Carp Society through Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, and Twitter. Tag us with your captures, hashtag American Carp Society and hashtag Join the Guilty Ones, and we will feature you on the feed. You can contact me directly with any questions that you have, Sean@AmericanCarpSociety.com. Be lucky, everyone.